The principal concern of students of Christianity in modern times has been to discover how and to what degree it's possible to reconcile the spiritual aspects of Christianity with the temporal. Debate, speculation, and research have all concentrated on that one problem, namely, to what degree, if any, can or must a spiritual message be implemented by physical organization, formal offices, tangible ordinances. The two extreme points of view were magnetic poles, and few were the churchmen who were not drawn either to the one or the other in the 19th century. The one pole was that the operation of the Spirit precluded the existence of any formal organization. You have the Spirit, you don't need a church. Any church. The other pole was that the operation of the church completely superseded the unpredictable and unreliable offices of direct revelation. To the one school, the Spirit was everything. To the other, the church was everything. Let us consider the first pole first. The war cry of the liberals was that the idea of direction and government through the Spirit absolutely precluded any idea of a physical church set up on this earth. A favorite argument was that the nearness of the expected end of all things obviated the need for a church. The eschatology of Jesus, to quote one authority, was the decisive argument against the founding of a church by him. The fashion of this world passeth away. Here we have no abiding kingdom, and here accordingly is no place for any such thing as an established church. If the end was at hand and the Lord was approaching, these men asked, what need for a church? To this they added the spiritual argument. A leading Protestant divine of our own day recently wrote, quote, the Protestant affirms that God has not placed between him and man a hierarchy of saints, bishops, and priests through whom alone the individual can enter into his presence. On the contrary, we declare that God spoke to Moses in the burning bush, that is, he spoke to Samuel in the temple, to Paul on the road to Damascus, by his Holy Spirit, so God still guides men through the still small voice of conscience, unquote. Both these proofs for the non-existence of an original church rest in the end, you will notice, on historical assumptions. And on historical evidence, they both break down. To take the latter point first, the historic illustrations just quoted are quite sufficient in themselves completely to refute their author's stand. God, speaking to Moses from the burning bush, to Samuel in the temple, and to Paul on the road to Damascus, were personal experiences to which these three prophets bore witness. If this was God speaking through the still small voice of conscience, then those three men were grossly abusing that conscience by describing its operation in such extravagant and misleading terms that those who hear their stories are moved to marvel at the strangeness and wonder of them. For though we daily experience the still small voice of conscience, which of us has ever had an experience remotely resembling these? Almost as soon as the Didache was discovered in 1883, von Harnack was able to show from it that however spiritual the primitive church might have been, it was also highly organized. And he went on to ask the question that should have been natural enough even before the great discovery, namely, what in the world is there to prevent a man who holds an office from being directed by the Spirit? And what is there to prevent a spiritual man from being appointed to an office? Nay, it would seem, Harnack concluded, not only that the power and gifts of the Spirit can be possessed by one holding an office in the church, but very probably, as far as the ancient church was concerned, they must be. If the office without the Spirit is a dead thing, is not the Spirit without the office an ineffectual one? As to the argument that the primitive Christians would take no thought of any kind of organization, since they expected the immediate end of all things, psychology and scripture would support the opposite conclusion. The fact that they were making a last-ditch stand would tend to draw the saints closer together, as many scholars were prompt to point out. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, says Paul, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as ye see the day approaching. The end was coming, the more need for the church, not the less. Forced to admit that some sort of organization did exist in the early church, the scholars then tended to favor the theory that such an organization was a spontaneous, local, loose sort of thing. Clubs of like-minded spiritual individuals would spontaneously gather together, you know, in little communities, and they were only welded together into a central church organization through a long process of evolution. Now, it's true that the modern Christian churches can be plainly shown to be the product of just such a process of growth and adjustment. But it's equally clear that the early Christian church was not an evolved institution. There, says Harnack, the development goes from the whole to the part, and not the other way around. Ecclesia, wrote Zohm, means Gesamtkirche, the general church, of which the local churches were only copies. The local church, he says, was a scale model of the main church, which came before all the others. This is plainly seen in the fact that originally all the local churches had the same officers and ordinances, which would not have been the case had they grown up independently. It was only after the apostles passed away and general authorities disappeared that each church went its own way. Then they differed, so that by the 5th century, Sozomen can report that in his own day, rather Socrates, no two churches do things the same way, writing about 451. No two churches have the same Easter ordinances, he says, for example. Sherman observed that the mere existence of set rites and ordinances in the early church was itself evidence for a set organization, without which they would be unthinkable. Of these ordinances, Hans Lietzmann pointed in particular to those of initiation into the church, as proving beyond a doubt the existence of a close-knit overall organization. The earliest records speak of definite rules for joining the church. Baptism, the most important. Lietzmann points this out, and he says these rules are fully developed in the Acts and the Epistles, a situation which is quite unthinkable without a rather strict organization. Then Karl Hold, pointing to the well-known fact that the Christian church was from its very inception a missionary organization, drew the obvious conclusion, quote, that no missionary church begins with autonomous branches. Missionary work always spreads from some center or other and is concerned with bringing others into a well-defined group. As late as 1950, T.W. Manson, the famous English scholar, noted that in the earliest records of all, the gospel, he says, we begin with the fact that Jesus did gather a community around himself during the course of his ministry. And we may well ask what it was if it wasn't the church. It will not do, says Manson, to regard this group merely as a more or less regular, the more or less irregular disciples of a somewhat unorthodox traveling rabbi. The more the synoptic evidence is studied, the more clearly the fact emerges that what Jesus created was something more than a new theological school. It was a religious community of which he was the leader. End of quote. It has taken the Protestant scholars 50 years to come around to this, and yet today the strong consensus is that the church was not a product of late and gradual evolution, and in all camps the dependence of the individual on the church, rather than the church on the individual, is now being emphasized. This may be taken as the trend characteristic of the times and seems rather to favor the second or the other pole of theory which we mentioned at the outset, that which places the operation of the church above all other things. In the last analysis, the two conflicting schools really agree perfectly on the fundamental premise, namely that you don't need both the spiritual gifts and a church organization. They agree on that. The 19th century schools, in the name of the Spirit, abolished the church. Their opponents, in the name of the church, had long before ruled out the gifts of the Spirit. That came very early. The fathers of the 4th century definitely regard the church as taking over entirely all the functions once reserved to prophets and revelation. John Chrysostom says that the members of his church are always and everywhere, as he says, always and everywhere asking him, what has happened to the spiritual gifts? Why do we no longer have the gift of tongues? Where are the prophets? Why are men no longer chosen for office as they were anciently by direct revelation from heaven? This worries him, and his answer is always that the church no longer has these gifts because it no longer needs them. They were, he says, like a scaffolding to support a new structure, which is taken down as soon as the building is finished, or they're like a prop which a gardener supports a young tree. As soon as the tree becomes strong and vigorous, the prop is taken away because it's no longer needed. That's the standard explanation to this day. Of course, neither John nor his hearers were completely satisfied with this answer. For the plain implication of it is that the church of the apostles was spiritually weaker than the church of their own day, a thing which they very well knew was not the case. Nevertheless, that was the official answer. The church had taken over the offices anciently filled by the Spirit. St. Augustine has a great deal to say on this subject. We need mention only here his argument that the church has superseded all revelation. Repeatedly, he declares that he believes only what the church tells him to believe, and only because the church tells him to believe it. This may seem a paradoxical position for the man who himself was prescribing the fundamental theology which the church was to follow for centuries to come. But what other stand can he take, since he insists that revelation has ceased, and he can't put himself up as the ultimate depository of divine authority? When we read the Gospels, Augustine maintains Christ the Head speaks to us through the voice of the church. This, you'll see, is the opposite role, or the opposite pole, from the claim that he speaks only in the still small voice of the individual conscience. But it is just as far removed from any real idea of revelation. Even though he could speak in his own person, Augustine says, still Christ has committed his voice henceforth to the church alone. Her voice is his voice. In vain you argue, he tells the Pelagians, for though no reason can explore and no speech can explain it, whatever is believed by the whole church is true. Since Augustine well knew in his long controversies with various sects that the whole church never saw eye to eye on any doctrine, he falls back again and again on his favorite argument for the authority of his church. It is the true church, he says, because it is the biggest. Among many competing sects, it has the most members, and is to be found in the most places. Therefore, he says again and again, it must be the true church. That is his favorite, and in dealing with the Donatist, is virtually his only argument for the authority of his church. It's a strangely geographical sort of argument, earthbound, as we say, and leaves no room for revelation. But long before Augustine's day, the loss of spiritual gifts in the church had caused grave concern in many breasts. Bishop John of Bristol, perhaps the foremost Anglican church historian of the last century, of the early last century, has written an interesting thesis on this subject. He says the miraculous powers conferred upon the apostles were the credentials by which they were to prove that they were the bearers of a new revelation from God to man. We might therefore infer from the purpose for which they were conferred that they would, in the process of time, be withdrawn. This is Chrysostom's theory, the theory for which neither man can give scriptural authority. Indeed, the scripture says, these signs shall follow them that believe. My conclusion then is, Bishop John continues, after discussing the gradual loss of gifts in the church, that the power of working miracles was not extended beyond the disciples upon whom the apostles conferred it by the imposition of their hands. As the number of those disciples gradually diminished, the instances of exercise of miraculous powers became continually less frequent and ceased entirely at the death of the last individual upon whom the hands of the apostles had been laid, a date which Bishop John places before the middle of the second century. The good bishop then proceeds to disprove his own theory of the purpose of miracles by noting that the early Christians were not at all reconciled to the loss of the spiritual gifts, but missed them sorely. After all, did the missionary work of the church come to an end before the middle of the second century? Most Christians would say that it was just beginning, and they would say that the specific purpose of miracles was to foster just that work. If the church were really being set up in the earth, miracles should not have ceased then of all times. What then would be the effect produced upon the minds of the great body of Christians by their gradual secession? This is Bishop John speaking again. And he answers, many would not observe. None would be willing to observe it, for all must naturally feel a reluctance to believe that powers which had contributed so essentially to the rapid diffusion of Christianity were withdrawn. The silence of ecclesiastical history respecting the cessation of miraculous gifts in the church, he says, is to be ascribed to the combined operation of prejudice and policy, of prejudice which made them reluctant to believe, of policy which made them anxious to conceal the truth, namely that they had lost the priesthood. I perceive in the language of the fathers, Bishop John continues, who lived in the middle and the end of the second century, if not a conviction, at least a suspicion that the power of working miracles was withdrawn, combined with an anxiety to keep up a belief in its continuance in the church. They affirm in general terms that miracles were performed, but they rarely venture to produce an instance of a particular miracle. Those who follow them are less scrupulous and proceed to invent miracles. End of quote. A most remarkable witness to the cessation of heavenly gifts in the church, and especially of prophecy, was the celebrated Tertullian, whom we so often quoted, the first and in many ways the greatest of the Latin fathers. He seems to have been a convert, though we don't know for sure, joined the church in Carthage at about the age of 40. He was one of the great lawyers of his day. Tertullian was not a man to be fooled. He wanted to know things for himself. and he made himself the foremost authority to this day, we might say, on the nature and institutions of the original Christian church. Like Clement and Justin Martyr before him, he was predisposed by long and laborious study in the schools of the pagans to recognize and appreciate those special characteristics of the Christian teaching which set it off sharply from all other doctrines. He knew, as they knew, that philosophers, administrators, journalists, scholars, orators, and teachers, if not quite a dime a dozen, can be trained up in any desired amount. But not so with prophets. The gift of prophecy was for Tertullian the strongest recommendation of divinity of the Christian church. And it was only when painful experience had convinced him beyond a doubt that the main church no longer possessed that gift that he did an amazing thing. Tertullian, commonly called the Puritan of the early church, the man who placed zeal for salvation above all other considerations, who showed by word and deed that no sacrifice was too great provided only he gained that salvation, Tertullian left the church. In doing so, he did not change his mind about the gospel. What he did was to join the Montanists, a strictly orthodox sect who differed from the main church in one important thing. They preached that the gift of prophecy must be found in the church if it's the true church. That was what Tertullian was after. At the time of his going over, he wrote a remarkable work in which he accuses the main church of having supplanted the authority of revelation by the authority of office and numbers. Because they have the teaching, he says, the doctrinum of the apostles, he reminds the clergy, it doesn't follow that they have their authority, their potestat. All men, he says, are governed by discipline, but power comes only from God by the Spirit. The apostles work not by the formal operation of discipline, but by power direct from God. Show me, therefore, he says, you who would be apostolic, some prophetic examples, and I will acknowledge the divinity of your calling. It is true, he says, they have ministerium, the official calling, but that, he says, is not imperium, the actual possession of power, the right to give orders. The spiritual power of the church is that exercised only by apostles and prophets. For, he says, quote, the church is the Spirit working through an inspired man. The church is not a number of bishops. The final decision remains with the Lord, never with the servant. It belongs to God alone, not to any priest, unquote. Tertullian says much more in this vein. Whether one agrees with him or not, he shows us that the issue was clearly drawn at a very early date, middle of the third century. Already there were two factions in the church, those who precluded office by the Spirit and those who supplanted Spirit by office. The only solution to the problem is, as Tertullian clearly sees, in the presence of the power of prophecy in the church.